When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Tasha Robinson
and
Genevieve Kosky.
Keith Phipps, who's normally here, is on vacation. He'll be back for our next installment. Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current release. This week, something big is happening. We've seen the signs. We have the coordinates. Tasha, I think this episode is going to be out of this world.
Yes, they thought we were crazy, but after 5 months of diligent podcasting, The Next Picture Show finally makes contact. Our pairing this week is Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Jeff Nichols' Midnight Special, two movies about humans who quest for the otherworldly. Both follow characters who have absolute faith in the outlandish prospect of an alien rendezvous, and that faith is miraculously rewarded in the end. In Close Encounters, Richard Dreyfuss stars as an electrician from Indiana who gets so close to a UFO that it burns half his face. It turns out that many people from around the world, including scientists and government agents, have experienced strange occurrences and visions too. All roads lead to Devil's Tower in Wyoming, but the question is whether this close encounter will be a friendly one. The same madness underscores Midnight Special, which also sends various groups of people toward the same set of coordinates. The only evidence we have of an alien presence is an 8-year-old boy with special powers, but that's enough to attract the interest of a religious cult and government agents and inspire his parents to go on the run to protect him. Midnight Special clearly owes a debt to Close Encounters, but while the two films work toward a similar ending, they don't necessarily work toward the same ends.
No, they don't. The connections between these two movies are fascinating because they say so much about the director's agendas and the times in which they are made. On today's show, we'll dig into the wonders and optimism of Close Encounters. Then, on the second half, we'll contrast it with a darker vision of Midnight Special. Tasha, Genevieve, just close your eyes and hold your breath, and everything will turn real pretty.
The only thing these phrases have in common are 5 seconds.
I hope somebody's taking all this down.
What are we saying to each other?
It seems they're trying to teach us a basic tonal vocabulary.
It's the first day of school, fellas.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind is premised on a radical optimism. What if an alien invasion could be a positive experience? As consumers of science fiction, we've been taught to expect otherwise, that surely, if an alien race were sophisticated enough to find the planet Earth, the best we could expect is to be probed mercilessly like the crude, inferior species that we are. But mostly, we can expect to be destroyed. Drawn from Spielberg's memories and dreams as a stargazing kid, and influenced by the song When You Wish Upon a Star, Close Encounters of the Third Kind seems like an extension of and a rebuke to the advances made by Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey nearly a decade earlier. Kubrick's film awed audiences with the possibilities of outer space and celestial encounters, but took a pessimistic view of where those adventures might lead. There are sequences in Close Encounters that mirror the quiet marvels of 2001, but Spielberg, a populist to the core, takes a sunnier view of technology and the potential for interstellar communication. For him, the unknowns of space promise a chance to transcend our limitations, not smack against them like a brick wall. There's a pleasing order to the universe in Close Encounters, even though Spielberg takes his time making sense of it. There's no guarantee that humans will benefit at all from making contact. When a little boy from a farm in Muncie, Indiana gets sucked up into an alien ship, there's no reason to expect a good outcome. There's also a frightening pathology to Richard Dreyfuss terrorizing his family and completely dismantling his home out of a strange, hostile compulsion. Then there's the government itself, which is going to great lengths to keep American citizens from finding out about these extraordinary happenings in their backyard. When Spielberg finally brings humans and aliens together at Devil's Tower, he faces the difficult task of dramatizing a harmonious affair. Suddenly, This movie that seemed to be about otherworldly threats and government secrets becomes a movie about two vastly different cultures finding some way to communicate. If two alien races can find common ground, Spielberg suggests, then surely human beings can settle their differences too. So, you know, there's a lot to talk over here, Tasha and Genevieve, but let's start with a core question. Does Close Encounters of the Third Kind still have the power to awe you, Tasha Robinson, and why?
You know, this may be a silly way of looking at it, but if I had stopped, I hadn't seen this since the 80s, and rewatching it, I found that a lot of it just feels really problematic to me from like a character standpoint and sometimes from a storytelling standpoint. And if I had stopped watching at the point where they get to the top of Devil's Tower and see the government installation, I would have said, no, this is not a particularly awesome movie. And then pretty much everything after that. Our parent podcast, Film Spotting, often says it got dusty in the theater, which, I'm going to own it. I teared up. And I teared up because not because of dust, but because of emotions. That moment when the mothership slowly like edges its way over the top of Devil's Tower is just it's still breathtaking. It's still awe-inspiring. And part of that in the back of my head is knowing that this was all done with practical effects and, and seeing like the detail of what they built to create this effect. But part of it is just the otherworldliness of it all. And I think that one of the things Close Encounters does is steep you so deeply in various aspects of like mundane day-to-day life that once you're really taken out of it, once you really see the vastness of what humanity is up against, it becomes a kind of a look at the ineffable. And because Spielberg leaves so much open to wonder about what that ineffable is and what it means, it leaves you feeling like you've been touched in a religious way, because a lot of the questions are very religious. Okay, now why are we here? What does this mean? Like, what does this power want with us? While feeling very dwarfed by it. Yeah, it's still a pretty awe-inspiring movie.
I think just so much of that, too, is in the sound and those notes. And music just has such a primal power. And this movie obviously taps into that power in a very memorable way. We were all doing the notes as we were setting up for this podcast. But yeah, Tasha, I don't want to call it problematic, but I did find myself a lot more unsettled on this viewing than I remember ever being before. And again, it's been probably close to 20 years, let's say 15 years since I've seen this movie. So it's my first time seeing it as an adult. And like Roy losing his mind and deciding to leave his family and hopping on a spaceship to God knows what, like that all struck me as a lot more kind of terrifying this time around than I ever remembered it being. And I'm certainly not the first person to make that observation, but just as far as my personal reaction goes, I felt myself getting a lot more hung up on that aspect of it than I remember, you know, feeling when I was 15 or whenever I saw this movie.
Yeah, it occurs to me now that you talk about it, that and you talked about the religious aspects of it, and you talked about the pathology, I suppose, of the Roy character, of how much maybe that more most recent that Aronofsky take on Noah's Ark seems to take that same idea of just of this devoted family man who is given this mission that just transcends absolutely everything.
I actually just rewatched Interstellar, and that has aspects of that too.
Jeff Nichols' Take Shelter came to mind a lot watching this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll get to it with Midnight Special as well, which is really again about cases where this mission that seems impossible, improbable, otherworldly, transcends the things that you have and consider important. Yeah, I mean it is fascinating the amount of I guess of real like emotional violence that Roy exerts over his family. I mean his wife, she flees the house. Yeah. It is. I mean, once he gets past the mashed potatoes is one thing, but like once he is taking
shoveling dirt into the window,
right, and throwing and breaking windows and
wrecking the poor neighbor's duck farm.
He needed the chicken wire.
I don't know. Well, clearly it's duck wire. That's just one level of his delusion.
Something else that also struck me this time is that I feel like kind of what I've always heard, like the line on this movie is kind of what you were saying in the keynote, that this interaction between, you know, humans and this alien species is, you know, sort of benevolent or, you know, it's about communication. But I don't know that I buy that these aliens are necessarily benevolent. Like, they did cause several people to lose their minds, and they did abduct these pilots for their entire lives. Like, they come back and they're still the same age as when they left, but they've lost their entire lives on Earth, and like, that's really unsettling. And maybe just
they've gone all Steve Rogers.
Yeah,
like they're gonna be dumped in the middle of Times Square and freak out.
Right, it's like they give Barry back, but what about all those soldiers? And also that spindly adult alien, really don't like that guy at all.
We're gonna have to talk about adult. Okay, first of all, you don't like him because he reminds you of a spider.
Yes.
Let's just get that out.
I'm willing to admit that.
You're extremely
But also, like, you can't even come out of the ship, dude. Come on.
Well, okay. I mean, we can talk about whether it's that the adult alien, because if so, like, he's sending it feels like he's sending a kindergarten class out to, like, pick the next teacher. We're talking about aliens here. For all we know, that was the kid, and it was like, all right, you can have a peek at Earth, but then the adult's got to go do some serious Richard Dreyfuss selecting.
Well, let us concede that these aliens really probably do have the power to do a lot of harm.
Yeah.
a lot more harm than they do. And we could maybe say that...
They're just casing the joint before they blow it up.
That these abductions that have taken place, maybe there's a gentle probing rather than a truly...
A loving probing.
Yeah, something a little bit... Well, nothing untoward, kinky.
Nothing that'll lose us our clean rating on iTunes.
No, nothing like that. But there is... But when you get to the core scene of the human species, of the alien species communicating, that strikes me as a peaceful exchange, no? Or no?
I don't know if peaceful is necessarily the word. I mean, it's quite loud, but... Yeah. I mean, it's probing in its own way. It's investigative. It's like trying to determine on what level this inferior species is capable of communicating with us. And like, for all, like, yeah, they do communicate, but there's not necessarily information exchanged there, you know? And I'm not saying that, like, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind 2, you know, where they come back and blow up Earth. I'm not saying, like, that's what this is suggesting. I'm just saying there was a vibe I felt this time around. Like, this could go bad. It obviously doesn't go bad.
No.
Well, unless you count Richard Dreyfuss leaving.
I think the Earth can do without a Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah.
Maybe not Richard Dreyfuss,
but can do without Roy.
Well, yeah, for sure. maybe they just showed up to find out whether we could jam.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty complicated sequence they had there.
Maybe Gangly Alien is like alien version of Kanye, and he just like he needed somebody else to collaborate with before he dropped his latest mix.
Okay, so I'm gonna play the host here, and I'm gonna stop you right there. And I actually want to go back to talk about something that you pinpointed, which I thought was a really interesting insight about how well the film establishes, you know, certain domestic details in such a way to make the transcendent elements of the stuff we see later in the film more powerful. Because I think that's something that Spielberg does extraordinarily well, is create these really lived in chaotic domestic spaces. That to me is what that was just that was compelling enough in the first part. Forget about even all of the alien stuff. I just Roy at home and his kid in the playpen slamming that doll, plastic doll, over and over again. It just felt like he understood how the American home as an organism functioned in a way that so few filmmakers get.
Okay, you're the only one at the table with kids,
yes.
And if that's how your household functions, I'm a little worried, because I did not enjoy that vision of chaos, particularly that child smashing what is very clearly his sister's doll. Mm-hmm. I mean, his sister looks like she's maybe a little old for a playpen. It's possible that neither the playpen or the doll are in use anymore.
Okay, I was, you know, speaking personally, playpen wise, I can talk about the playpen. I used to play that thing until I was way too old to be like I'd throw toys out of it, climb out of the playpen, get the toy, go back into the playpen. Anyway, is that this about Close Encounters? This is about me.
It's certainly about you. And
Close Encounters is about all of us.
Yeah.
Your desire to.
I'm just saying,
stuff.
You can play pins. You can kind of keep using. Is what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, this is me. I mean, the whole playpen thing is me trying to excuse the fact that neither Roy nor Ronnie does anything about the fact that this little boy is clearly smashing his sister's doll to pieces. I mean, yeah. Roy, you can kind of excuse this. Like, he's clearly a kind of like neglectful, like 80s father. Like, he seems to have the attitude that like the kids are mostly his wife's business, and his business is apparently determining which movie he's going to pay for everybody to go see. There's like a definite sense of, before Ronnie enters that scene, there's kind of a sense of like, oh, this is dad. We come to dad when we want something paid for. And other than that, like, he's not really going to take much responsibility for the kids. But then Ronnie enters and she just kind of glances at the middle kid smashing this doll and then goes to talk to her husband. And to me, that's just kind of the beginning of this thing that goes throughout the movie, where the household is just this center of chaos and unpleasant feelings. Hmm. I thought their family dynamic was horrible, and it gets much more horrible at the point where Roy is breaking down and desperately asking his wife for help, and she's slapping him and shoving him away and talking about how it's all his fault that the home has fallen into chaos. And for me, there's that scene where the two of them kiss by the roadside, but that's really the only moment in the film that feels like there's any affection in this marriage. And at the point where he's begging her for help and she's shoving him away and blaming him for everything that's happened, I didn't feel any sense of like affection or respect or caring there. I thought their relationship was really ugly. Mm. And it almost felt like it was being set up that way specifically so we won't feel too bad when he takes another option and leaves the planet.
I wonder which version, if you watch the, I think the 1998 version, because I'm not super well versed in all the different versions of this movie. I know the 1980 like collector's edition or whatever is one that added the mothership sequence at the end.
There's the theatrical, the director's cut, and the special edition.
Yeah, and from what I understand, like, Spielberg added kind of more and more domestic stuff within each release to, I think, kind of justify Roy's actions. And because I'm not recalling everything that you're talking about, and I'm pretty sure I watched the 1977 original edition. So I'm wondering if you may have watched the 1998 director's. I think that's the director's cut.
Yeah, I watched the director's cut. Yeah.
I watched the version that's streaming on Amazon, and they don't really specify which version it is.
Yeah, because the version I watched, I don't recall the slapping him that you are talking about.
She doesn't slap him across the face. She smacks his hands. Like, he reaches for her and she like physically knocks him away.
Well, I do think that it speaks to what I read, where Spielberg did kind of add more and more of these moments of domesticity, I think, like I said, to kind of justify Roy's departure. And that certainly makes sense based on what you just said.
Well, just out of curiosity, I mean, do you remember a scene where he's in the shower, fully clothed, with the bright light in the bathroom?
That is definitely from what I read, that is definitely from the most recent director's cut.
Oh, wow.
So that is not the one I saw.
Interesting, because my version had the mothership.
Yeah, Spielberg hated the mothership and took it out of subsequent releases.
Roger.
Yeah. So don't quote me on that. I wish Keith was here, because this is,
directors, like, make a movie and be done with it.
I know. But
go make a second.
But while we're talking about domiciles, you know, this doesn't quite fit into the discussion of suburbia. But I thought Jillian and Barry's house is very kind of interesting as well, in that, because they're in a more rural area.
Muncie.
Yeah.
Muncie is apparently like a giant abandoned field with lights in the distance.
Yeah,
that's also where Tim Robbins is from in the Hudsucker Proxy.
Go Eagles.
Oh, but that sense of like, you know, clutter and, you know, your house kind of encroaching in on you, that I definitely felt that in Jillian's home as well, but it's just her and her son. Like, she's a single mom and they're so isolated out there. And the moment that got me is like when Barry goes outside after the ship and you just see the incredible starry sky and these like incredibly bright stars, and it just really drives home that they're in the middle of nowhere and they're isolated in a way that Roy's family is not. Like, there's a voyeuristic element to their place in the suburbs when Roy is losing his mind and he's doing it in front of the neighbors and they're all watching, and it's mortifying to his wife and family, and they leave. And so it's interesting, these two kind of similarly chaotic homes in two very different settings.
Yeah. That's a good point. One thing I would say to defend, I guess, the marriage between Roy and Ronnie is I think they're a couple that sort of, in the beginning of the film, is in a domestic routine. They have their roles. And I think if there's hostility between them, it's that Ronnie is upset that he is not doing his job and is not, it has become this unstable figure who is creating unrest in their home. But I like that observation about, you know, I mean, their troubles, when they have them, do become a neighborhood spectacle. The nosy neighbor who looking out the window all the time. And then when she skips town, I mean, everyone knows about it.
Yeah.
Although it's interesting to note, in both cases, like, there's no help to be had. In one case, there's a lot of witnesses to the trouble, but the fact that there are all of those neighbors nearby just means there are people to, like, stare at them and judge them. In the same way that Barry, it's such an incredible shot that you're evoking, he's running off and you don't see the ship, but that's what he's going after. And as soon as he gets away from the light of the house, like the little sort of puddle of light in the corner of the screen that the house has created, he disappears and he's gone. Mm-hmm. And there's no one to see that happen. In the suburbs, when Roy is freaking out, everybody's standing around watching. Nobody makes a move to intervene. Nobody calls the cops. Nobody helps Ronnie and the kids either. They're just all... they're kind of dumbstruck in a very Spielbergian way. Mm-hmm. So either way, they kind of have to rely on themselves.
One quick detail, going back to Jillian's house. I also found myself just caring a lot more about Jillian and Barry this time around than about Roy and his family. I'm a child of a single mother, maybe that's where this is coming from. But mm-hmm. I love, like, the first time we meet Jillian, she's in bed. And, you know, noise is happening and she gets out of bed and she's wearing her clothes. She's wearing, like, jean shorts and a blouse or something.
Such
and
it
just,
detail.
Yeah. And it's just like, she just collapsed mm-hmm. in bed, you know, it like her life as a single mom in this huge house that she obviously can't quite stay on top of is exhausting. And that's just such a little perfect little domestic moment.
The other thing too about that location is just that, you know, when you're, it's so iconic seeming and you're out on a farm and it's it's open skies, you know, there's just an aesthetic beauty to that location. It seems like the right place to get abducted from, is
right,
what I'm saying.
Exactly.
Is it possible though that the reason that you feel so much more attached to Jillian and Barry is because they show authentic feeling for each other? I mean, she really seems to love her son. He really seems to love her. There's an attachment there. And when they're separated, it's a heartbreaking thing. Whereas when Roy leaves his family and goes off to Devil's Tower, it's kind of a relief.
Yeah, Jillian has clearly been addled in a similar way to Roy. Like, they mm-hmm. speak about having a similar experience. But the thing that drives her to Devil's Tower is at least partially, and I guess majority, going after her son, trying to get her son back. It's less this sort of psychotic obsession that Roy displays, and it's based in maternal instinct. It's based in something we can understand and relate to emotionally, whereas, you know, the aliens scrambled my brains and now I have to go to them is, you know, a lot harder to process, I think, emotionally.
But Roy treats her much more sort of tenderly and humanely mm-hmm. than he does. So I think it becomes a thing where it's just a shared experience, mm-hmm. and if mm-hmm. if you haven't shared that experience, you're alienated from it. So Roy, once he does come into contact with her and her situation, and they both share a common goal, he doesn't seem as crazy anymore,
yeah.
and doesn't act as crazy anymore, and the mission makes more sense. I don't know. I guess there seem like they're less destructive ways to figure out where they need to go to Devil's Tower.
Camping trip. Surprise camping trip, guys.
Well, I mean, when he grabs his whole family out of bed at 4 in the morning and packs them all end of the truck. Yeah. Like, that's sort of a surprise camping
trip. Yeah.
I've read that that's what inspired this movie, is that Spielberg's parents apparently shoved them all in the car on no notice in the middle of the night and took them tearing off through the night. And it turned out they were going to go watch a fantastic meteor shower. Mm-hmm. But that image just kind of impressed itself on him, and he kind of reflects it here. You talk about sympathizing more with Jillian and Barry than with Roy and his family. One thing that I found on this viewing that didn't strike me at all as a kid was I found myself very sympathetic with Roy and Ronnie's children. Mm. You see a lot of them distressed and frightened and crying and angry, lashing out. And watching it, I mean, I got the same reaction to when the aliens are shaking Jillian and Barry's house, and Jillian is terrified, and Barry seems kind of delighted. First of all, I kept thinking, how did they keep that kid so happy when the actress playing Jillian, Melinda Dillon, seems completely freaked out and is like screaming and hanging on to him? Like, you would think that would wig out a 2-year-old who's trying to be like told to play make believe. But I kept thinking, watching this must have been so traumatic for children. And then I look back to my own childhood, and like that scene, when I first saw that scene at the dinner table where his children are weeping and his wife is screaming at him because he's playing with the mashed potatoes. When I watched that as a kid, I was just like, oh, the funny man's playing with mashed potatoes, and that's silly. Like, none of the rest of it made an impact on me.
Yeah.
We talked just a little bit about, you know, the domestic scenes in the film, but I also wanted to ask you all about other aspects of the film that mark it as a Steven Spielberg film. I mean, what about Close Encounters is Spielbergian?
Well, people looking up at the sky in awe.
Yeah.
With their mouths hanging open.
Yeah, this is kind of the quintessential movie for that, for sure.
Yeah, a lot of people have done essays about Spielberg face. Our old pal Kevin B. Lee did a video of Spielberg face that's just a bunch of like that Spielbergian look up into, with mouth hanging open, staring at something in wonder. I highly recommend that. You can find it online.
Well, the sequence with the kid, with the boy looking around, I mean, that's one of the most famous bits of child acting that of all time. I mean, everyone talks about that scene, about how Spielberg was able to elicit these responses from this kid who was, you know, not an actor, he's just a kid. Related to that, too, related to Spielberg's thing about going to those faces first, is that he also finds these offhand ways of suggesting a presence, the presence of something without going there directly. You know, he'll go to like a series of mailboxes that are shaking and opening up, you know, and of course Jurassic Park has the bit with the glass of water trembling. It's just a clever, purely visual way of establishing something, and he does it like nobody else.
There's that something is coming feeling. There's also the John Williams score, obviously. Musically speaking, it's iconic, but Williams has a feel to him that's very, very grandiose and sweeping and epic. And he and Spielberg have worked together on more than 30 films. I was looking through their shared filmography, and I was actually surprised it was quite so many. But certainly that epic bombast, that sense, part of that sense of wonder comes from John Williams' score, and the way that Spielberg works it to drive the emotions home.
Spielberg also is good at creating tension in kind of unexpected ways, like mild tension. And the scene that I really felt that was when Roy is building the Devil's Tower in his living room, and there's the TV in the foreground that we can see this news report about, and we see Devil's Tower, and Roy doesn't see it, and it's like, is he gonna see it? And it goes on just long enough that you're like starting to get a little nervous. Yeah. Like, is he not going to see it? And then he does see it, obviously. But it's just a little bit of like visual wit that also creates a sense of tension and excitement, which I love.
Yeah, I think that's one of my favorite sequences in the movie, just for that reason, because you're like, come on. and you wait, they cut away, you know, the news broadcast, they'll cut away to Devil's Tower, and then they'll cut back to the newscaster, he misses it, it's like, please. Yeah. You know?
And it's not quite funny, like I wouldn't quite call it a joke, but like Spielberg is really good at like like, I guess you just call it wit, you know, mm-hmm. like not necessarily laugh out loud moments, but they're like, huh, yeah, I see what you're doing there, Stevie. Yeah,
there's also totally. Just, there's the apple-cheeked optimism of the whole thing, mm-hmm. you know, that feeling.
Which none of us felt this time.
No, we all thought it was just horrible. It was like, we all thought it was like, kind of like a you know, a Ken Loach film or something. So.
Well, the feeling that you get, I mean, one of the things he does here is create this gigantic tension and contrast between the domestic life that Roy has at home and the wonder of the rest of the cosmos. I think that's one of the reasons that the ending of the film feels so awe-striking, is because you spend so much time in like the muddy little corners of Ray's addled brain as his kind of mental illness gets worse and worse. And then when you open it up and you start seeing these, you know, another classic Spielbergian touch is those bright colored lights like shining through, like emitting beams of light, like that whole visual is a very Spielbergian thing. And suddenly it becomes just this very clean image that draws you out of all of the mundanity and all of the domesticity. The film itself as a whole, the domestic stuff may not have that kind of Norman Rockwell feel to them. And that takes me kind of back to E.T. mm-hmm. and the miserable, like, single mom trying to handle, like, a household full of, like, growing and increasingly chaotic kids. But then that film, E.T., you know, becomes a movie about childhood joy and wonder and like the excitement of being a child and the emotional connection with friends and all of this stuff. That's just a very Spielbergian thing itself, is that sense of community and happiness and positivity. Where, as you say, this could have been a movie about like the aliens showing up to probe everybody.
Well, and I mean, Spielberg did get there with War of the Worlds, you know, like, yeah. I mean, it's also worth pointing out that this is Spielberg at a very specific point in his career. Mm-hmm. And he is on record as saying that I would never have made Close Encounters the way I made it in 77 because I have a family that I would never leave. That was just the privilege of youth. He said that in a 1997 making of documentary. Mm. And I find that very interesting because, you know, we can talk about things being Spielbergian, but, you know, this is also a movie that he made in the very, very early part of his career. And it's a lot of these things we're just seeing the beta versions of what will come to be known as Spielbergian.
Yeah. Although, I mean, War of the Worlds is dark and like there's a lot of people die in very horrible ways, but in the end it does come down to family, and Tom Cruise's character's family survives under thoroughly ridiculous odds.
Well, yeah, it's the exact inverse of this, because the aliens are bad and family is reaffirmed at the end, and in Close Encounters aliens are good and he says, screw my family, I'm leaving, you know?
But either way, it's meant to feel like an
mother and son
choice.
Are reunited, yeah, in this,
right,
though. Well, and also, true, there's E.T. too. We should acknowledge E.T. as being, I think, much more in line with Close Encounters, as mm-hmm. being a much friendlier affair all around, really.
Yeah.
We talked
about pairing.
Though that's another one where the domestic scene is chaotic and a little alienating for young Henry. But that's for another podcast, yes. maybe down the line. You know, I think the other thing I really appreciate about the film is how much the confidence that Spielberg has to carry out the sequence at the end, because the stakes are pretty high, but, you know, and maybe, I guess, there is a little bit of a threat that's been established, because we don't necessarily know what they want from us. Maybe things could go awry, but really it is a sequence of sustained wonderment that we have to witness, and that's a very hard thing to stage, I think. You really have to blow people away purely on a filmmaking level in order to make that work. I mean, otherwise, if you don't have it on an effects level or on a filmmaking level, it's just not going to work at all, right?
Yeah. And the effects are amazing to this day. Like, mm-hmm. it's the Jaws principle, but not in that, like, for so long during that scene, even though I know we're going to see the aliens, I feel like we're not going to see the aliens. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it just feels like there is something just out of reach that's happening. And then when you do see it, like, it's very impressive, but it's still, like, straightforward. You know, it's not stylized, mm-hmm. Necessarily. And it makes it, I think, easier to appreciate the beauty that is there.
I think we see too much of the aliens, yeah. quite frankly. I think we should have seen maybe a third of what we see.
Do you mean a third fewer actual aliens or a third less time spent with the aliens?
Well, both of those things.
Because there's a lot of them.
And maybe one third of that spider alien.
We can just get rid of him altogether. I don't know. I don't want to assume.
So I guess we're all grateful that we did not go on the ship special edition.
No, I totally. I would be on board that ship. I would.
Really?
Sorry, my husband Bob, who is doubtless listening to this, and our three non-existent children. But bye, I'm on that ship.
Your cat just ran out of the room. It's clearly upset.
I'm not taking the cat. No, I actually have in my notes that this is the anti-Jaws because yes, we are teased with the idea of the aliens, and there's a bunch of what the hell are the aliens doing at Barry's house? Apparently, rattling around in the heating vents and shaking the doors. I don't know. But the spaceships themselves, we see like early and often and like close up and front on, like that moment when the ships come tearing around the corner.
Ice cream cone. Why does he think they look like ice cream cones? They don't look like ice cream cones.
One of them is apparently triangular shaped because I think Jillian says the same thing. Somebody says the same thing on that road that, it was shaped like an ice cream cone. Whatever. In my world, ice cream cones don't light up with 50 LEDs and 20 colors. But, you know, who knows? Who knows what happens in Spielberg land? But we see so much of the ships so often that, like, a little of the wonder dies down. But it also just becomes kind of this ongoing tease. Like, we see them so quickly and so much of them. It's like, what's going to be bigger and better? What's going to come next? And I think that drives a certain amount of excitement. The fact that it isn't perpetually something just off screen or a little glow in the clouds and then the ship shows up. It's like, he spends so much time with those ships that he has to impress you with the mothership. Like, something on that scale to take it up a notch.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I had a question for you all, because this figures in a little bit also with Midnight Special when we get to it. But is the government justified in keeping the public from knowing about these UFOs? Yeah, we see government agents as bad guys in E.T., but I don't know if they're so bad here.
Yeah, I feel like I'm supposed to say, like, no, but yeah, I mean, I think they are kind of justified. I mean, this is clearly, like, a huge expensive operation that is happening at Devil's Tower that could have disastrous consequences, and they just want to, like, keep people from poking around in there. Like, I mean,
yeah,
you know, but this was apparently, Close Encounters was originally conceived as a movie about, quote, UFOs and Watergate. And it's really interesting how far away it drifts from that mission statement. And I feel like there's
I don't think it drifts that far, though, actually. I didn't know that until you said it, but one of the points I was going to make was just about how this felt like it had the residue of those paranoid 70s thrillers that were happening.
Yeah, and maybe it's just because we're not steeped in that paranoia, or we're steeped in a very different kind of paranoia. It's like now we're in an era of, like, over transparency, and that's stressful in its own way. Mm-hmm. So maybe, like, in that context, like, it's certainly easier to get a reading of this government as a shadowy, secretive one.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also it's a true global collaboration.
Exactly, and it's like
an American French collaboration. For some reason, the rest of the world is
in India.
I don't know. I get the impression that they
no one can see me pointing to the sky, but no.
They go get the data from India, but sure, there's nobody at the site who appears to be a representative.
NATO? Can we say NATO?
but I do think, like, the sense of, like, exploratory curiosity and trust that these agencies are displaying and putting together this huge whatever they're doing at Devil's Tower, and, you know, getting a bunch of people to send off into space. Like, I mean, that's kind of, it's NASA, you know, and it's that belief in something bigger and pooling your resources to explore it. And there is something admirable about that, I think.
Oh, yeah. And a big part of that does come from having Truffaut there as apparently the chief guy in charge. Mm-hmm. We never really find out why some random French guy who, like, his scientific credentials are never given.
Seems smart.
His accent is his credentials.
He seems smart.
He's Truffaut.
I hope that's not the only qualification for being in charge of the first contact.
He figures the French New Wave.
Truffaut's scientist is actually apparently based on a real scientist named Jacques Vallée. Does that name ring a bell for anyone? I guess he met with Spielberg a few times when he was working on the film, and I guess he's, well, let's look up what Jacques Vallée is. In mainstream science, Vallée is notable for co-developing the first computerized mapping of Mars for NASA, and his work at SRI International and the Network Information Center for the ARPANET is a precursor to the modern internet.
Huh.
So, yeah, that's and he's
pretty smart.
Yeah, seems like
maybe
a good guy.
Than Truffaut.
Yeah, but I mean, point is,
come on, one of the leading figures.
He seems
like
wave.
Yeah, he's qualified. You're the one questioning his qualifications.
I'm not questioning his qualifications. I'm saying that I don't think that they come up in the film, and his presence is this strange anomaly. I mean, there's a lot in the first 10 minutes of the film. There's a lot of people yelling at each other in unsubtitled Spanish or French or Hindi. And the audience is just sort of left to go, okay, eventually.
That's what Bob Balaban's there for.
Yeah, and consider we're entering it, you know, in the middle. And I'm not going to say what the
in media res.
In media res. Uh-huh. We're entering in media res.
A lot of people screaming
and so
at each
other. So we should care about how people got to their station.
We will get into that in part two when we talk about the mysteries of this film and the mysteries of Midnight Special. But to answer your question, no, I don't think the government here is evil. And mostly that's because at no point, there does not seem to be a general in charge. There does not seem to be general in charge. I don't know. That one's pushing it.
I know.
Even for a
it was meta.
Another reference.
It was meta.
So there's nobody, like in an Independence Day style film, you would have someone in charge giving orders and like saying, we've got to keep this from the media, we've got to figure out how to weaponize this because we are evil, mwahaha.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no sense of that. No. Like, it really does feel like, okay, well, we need to keep civilians away because we don't want anybody messing up this conversation with things that are possibly so powerful they could lay waste to the planet.
Yeah.
No, but they are, you know, actively keeping our heroes from trying
and they're lying. They're saying, yeah, like, is that some gas or something, you know?
Yeah.
So they lie, but I don't think saying, like, hey, you know, we got some top secret project involving aliens and music notes over here is going to, you know.
Please don't come.
Everyone.
Yeah, please don't come. You're not invited.
Yeah, don't come.
Even those of you that were expressly invited are not invited.
Well, quickly, before we wrap up, I just wanted to go through and see what your favorite moment of the film was, Tasha.
Oh, it's a very small thing, but when they're playing the music tones to the three ships, which look strangely like the clapping monkey toy at the beginning of the film, like they have this band of lights across the bottom that look exactly like a toothy grin, and then they have two lights that look like bulbous eyes, and then a light that looks like a big nose. But the three of them are like flying in midair, and the humanity is desperately playing these tones at them, trying to get them to react. And they play the music back. That was where I teared up, because everybody's talking now, and it's such a fulfillment of something we were led to expect. And then they take off, and two of them like peel neatly off to the side, and the middle one like does a little loop-de-loop. And I could just see like the alien pilot of that ship going, "Wee!" It's a weirdly humanizing touch for aliens.
What about you, Genevieve?
Mine's a little different, and I think Tasha threw a little shade at it earlier, so I'm a little hesitant to bring it up, but I really like Barry's abduction, where this cluttered farmhouse feels like it's kind of coming alive, and
yeah,
it's an extension of the ship outside.
Tasha, were you dissing that earlier?
I was dissing that a little bit.
Sheesh. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm dissing your dissing of that sequence, because I find it absolutely thrilling, this idea that, because there's no place to escape to. Like, the house is coming alive and seems like it's attacking, but you can't run outside because the thing that's attacking is out there. And it's I think it's the real payoff of that house, of that iconic house that you talk about. Mm-hmm. And all the stuff in it, and this old house, because old farmhouses like that do feel like they have a personality. And like, even though we know it is these beings outside that are causing this disruption, it does have a sense that the place is coming alive in a way. I held my breath during
that moment. No, I've got you. Yeah. We are two to one. We win that.
Nope. I'm going to outvote both of you by saying Poltergeist did it better.
That was later.
True. Scott, you going to give us your favorite moment?
I've got a couple. One very small moment. I liked Richard Dreyfuss teaching fractions to his kid via model train. It's like, people are going to die. You're going to figure it out. And then
thousands of lives are at stake.
And then I also liked the classic scene where he's on the road and he encounters the alien ship, and that's another great piece of visual wit when at mm-hmm. first there's a car that comes up behind him and you just see the headlights, and then he waves that car past, and then here comes the alien ship comes by, waves it past, and it moves in a different way than a car would.
Yeah.
And it's just that's such a wonderful classic Spielbergian moment,
and also another example of like almost missing information that we, the audience, have that the character almost misses.
Yeah.
Which is such a Hitchcockian thing. I mean, the TV set in the foreground with information that he needs in the background and isn't getting, like, that is classic Hitchcock. Mm. But the business with the ship just like lifting off behind him and he doesn't notice, Hitchcock wouldn't have done that.
That's good stuff. But now it is time for feedback.
Feedback time.
We need a song for it because it would make.
Someone send us a feedback time song. We'll use it.
Really?
Feedback time for us.
We should have Elliot.
Just auto-tune us.
Elliot Kalin from the Flophouse record a special feedback song because he does his mailbag song, his letter song. Anyway, so it's feedback time. Our last show on Psycho and 10 Cloverfield Lane drew a lot of responses from listeners who shared our enthusiasm for both films. Genevieve, want to get us started?
Sure. This one is excerpted from a longer email from listener Ben Sunday. He writes, "Watching Psycho, I was struck by how Marion's story in the beginning not only feels like it has a different protagonist from the rest of the film, but also a different genre. The crime plot that she finds herself involved in, which hinges on greed and a pivotal moment of weakness, echoes many stories from the film noir tradition that had just ended with Touch of Evil. In this first act, we therefore see a narrative structure the audiences in 1960 would have been very familiar with, and that they may have expected to play out exactly as it had before. Then a wrong turn leads Marion from the main highway to the Bates Motel, a mistake that also takes her away from the clear path of a film noir to the unexpected and disturbing world of a slasher. All the rules established within the former genre, that greed dictates all actions and that the main characters will survive until the climax, suddenly no longer apply to this new place and its proprietor, Norman Bates. For me, what makes Psycho scary is the sense of transportation from familiar territory to a strange place where the rules we take for granted no longer apply, though we naively assume they still hold true. And, blind to the genre we truly exist within, we see the gentle face of a hotel owner and greet it as something familiar and kind, though what it hides is unrecognizable and evil."
Yeah, I mean, I think that in a nutshell explains how effective that gear shift is in Psycho, is being transported not only in terms of story but in terms of genre, mm-hmm. from a crime film or sort of a moral drama to a horror film.
Yeah,
Hitchcock was very fond of breaking the rules. He was very fond of doing anything that surprised or shocked people. And we talked a lot about the marketing for the film and how gimmick-driven it was. But part of that was about taking the expressed, at the time, implied rules of what it was like to go to a movie in that era and breaking all of them for shock value. You know, telling people they weren't allowed to walk in the middle, telling people that they had to experience it in this one specific mm-hmm. way. It really feels like part of what makes Psycho so shocking is that he acknowledges the rules and plays by them until suddenly he's done with them. And there's no warning that that's coming.
Yeah, definitely. So given that we're talking about Close Encounters and Cosmic Coincidences today, we had to share this email from listener Richard, who found some harmony between Psycho, 10 Cloverfield Lane, in this very podcast. Tasha, could you read this one?
Sure. Richard writes, "This isn't an analysis of Psycho and 10 Cloverfield Lane. It's just something funny that I wanted to share with you folks. First, my birthday is April 4th. So is Anthony Perkins's. So each year I watch Psycho so we can share our birthdays together. Second, my local movie theater gives patrons a free ticket on our birthdays. And this year, I decided I was going to see 10 Cloverfield Lane with that ticket. So I was pretty tickled when I was adding podcast episodes to my iPod to listen to on the walk to and from the theater and discovered that not only would I see those movies today, but I would also be listening to your reviews of them. Just an interesting coincidence that I wanted to share with y'all. Thanks for your contribution to my birthday. You're doing good work. Love the show."
It wasn't a coincidence. We knew it was your birthday. How's that for a gear shift?
Wait till you see what we get you next year.
We really tailor this podcast specifically to one listener.
Wait till you see who we're tailoring today's the podcast to. It's going to be such a gear shift, you're never going to see it coming.
Okay, so finally, I wanted to address an email from a listener who did not like it when I said the words, people should not be allowed to watch movies.
Oh, Scott.
I know. Well, okay, let me explain. The context for that line was Keith's anecdote about seeing Psycho with a friend who'd never been exposed to it in any way, and the chatty folks behind them giving away the relationship between Norman and his mother before Hitchcock revealed it. I intended the line, people should not be allowed to watch movies, as a joke, but in case that was not clear, I should add that the Next Picture Show exists because of a shared passion for movies between ourselves and our listeners. We are people who watch movies, and of course we encourage other people to watch them too, and occasionally we make sarcastic jokes about people not being allowed to watch movies. But you know, our thing is like, wait to talk until the movie is over. Please, I think we can all agree on that, right?
Maybe not shout spoilers during the film.
No. I think your point was that if you're a person who regularly shares spoilers aloud during a film with other people around, you should not be allowed to watch movies.
Yeah, that's a solid point.
Yes.
I'm not being snobby.
No. Maybe people was too broad of a term.
Yeah.
But people like this one very specific person.
Yeah. No, they definitely should not. They should be thinking about this.
At least not allowed to watch them in public.
No.
Here's the thing. My first thought about that email was, oh, come on, it was a joke. But at the same time, I have been in the room multiple times with other critics that we have interesting conversations with and whose opinions we often respect, saying very dismissive things about being forced to watch movies with the hoi polloi mm-hmm. during public screenings where the public is invited, as though that's some kind of, you know, horrible burden. And whenever I hear somebody say that, I immediately think, ugh, you tiresome elitist snob. And it is entirely possible that they mean it as a joke and that they're just expressing frustration with someone who won't put their phone away or who like loudly talks or who is clearly vocally bored during the film. So as much as we kind of want to say, okay, lighten up, it was a joke, I've been on the wrong end of that joke. And, you know, if you feel strongly that, I don't know, people should be allowed to watch movies and that seeing movies with other people should not be a burden, I guess it is easy to take that statement, however lightly we intended it,
yeah,
is potentially offensive.
Abide by the social contract, people. That is my
And enjoy movies. We do.
Yeah, we do too. Yeah. Why, there's no other reason.
They're good things.
We're here.
We're glad they invented them.
So as always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on our website. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In the second half, we'll bring in Midnight Special and discuss how it twists a Close Encounter scenario to its own ends. Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow and follow us on Twitter @nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. And if those social media outlets aren't enough for you, here's something new and exciting. On Wednesday, April 13th, Reddit's True Film subreddit will be hosting an AMA with me, Keith Phipps, Tasha Robinson, and Genevieve Kosky. You can show up on Reddit to ask us anything about the podcast, about film, about fighting giant ducks or tiny horses, or anything else you want us to discuss. You can find the full details and a link to the AMA on our Twitter or Facebook account. And we really hope you'll tune in on April 13th and ask us anything. Until then, look to the skies. We are not alone.